All right, welcome to another episode of That's So Cincinnati. Jason Williams, along with my friend, sidekick, colleague, Sherry Coolidge. Silent Phil, as always, on the ones and twos. And Sherry, huge episode today. Lots of guests. Our special guest segment that we always have will be restaurateur, owner of Nicola's, Via Vite and Forno in Hyde Park and Montgomery, Christian Pietoso. Looking forward to having him here in a few minutes.
I feel like I might be outed. I did go to Nicola's two times this week on Monday and Tuesday nights. I planned a dinner there myself with two other couples, and then I was invited to a birthday party the other night that I could definitely not say no to. And I was like, oh, no. And then I was like, is that an oh, no? I think we'll just have to do some extra cycling.
This is when we go back to your Italian roots and refer to you as what your byline once was here at the Cincinnati Enquirer, Sharon Turco Coolidge.
Yes. Coolidge is my married name. In case you're wondering, Alex, I say it every once in a while. I am married to Alex Coolidge, who also works at the paper. I mean, people still ask me after being here for 20 years. They're like, are you related to Alex? Yes, I am. I met him at our last newspaper and brought him back here with me.
Youngstown, Italian through and through.
Yes, he's from Iowa.
But first, before we jump over and bring on Christian, we want to bring in some of our colleagues here. We've done this from time to time where we'll feature some of our journalism that's going on here. And right now, the Enquirer is doing a really big series on kids who kill. And it's a deep dive into violence and, you know, with involving children. And many, many reporters are involved, but our two key reporters on that are Kevin Grasha and Cam Knight. And they are right here with us today on the phone. And guys, how you doing?
We're doing great. Jason, how are you?
Good. Tell us a little bit about this project, Kevin. How did this come about, and what, you know, really what is kind of the overarching, you know, sort of what it's about?
I think it started because this year we had a pretty unusual case of a 14-year-old who is involved in four different homicides, or allegedly involved, and that led me to start tracking other juvenile cases. And then as the year went on, I started hearing that the youth detention facility was actually crowded with murder defendants. Mm. And at one point there were like 15, which was completely unheard of. And that was from, you know, some of the kids were from years past, but and then as the year went on, we got more information. And then Cam most recently got the number of kids who had been charged this year with murder and was able to compare it to previous years. And we had a total of 15 this year charged, which was more than the last previous 4 years combined.
Cam, why has there been an uptick in violence among youth?
There isn't really a very clear answer to that question, yeah. But I've been following the trend of like juveniles getting shot and things like that for several years. And I actually noticed that the number of kids getting shot started to bump up even before the pandemic. Back in 2019, we started to see those numbers tick up. So from law enforcement officials and probation officers and all the different folks that we talked to, you know, it's the factors that you would expect. It's the availability of guns. It's the neighborhoods that these kids grow up in, where it's becoming more and more common for kids to carry guns. It's social media amplifying arguments into things that turn deadly. One of the biggest factors that some of the people have outlined is just the amount of trauma that some of these kids have seen in their lives makes it really hard for them to make the decisions and to have access to the part of their brain that they need to steer them away from being impulsive, which we all were when we were teenagers. We were all impulsive. But when you throw a mix of guns and a bad environment and exposure to lots of violence in the rest of their life, it's just a deadly combination.
So when we were talking about as a group covering this, and you two were kind of our lead reporters and kind of kicked it off with explaining what's going on in our community, we kind of landed on, you know, everyone taking a role because it's a lot to cover. And Cameron and Kevin, I know on a day-to-day basis, I really admire you guys because you deal with these stories on a day-to-day basis and, you know, you see a lot of violence. And I know that's really, really difficult. Yeah. Like, it's one thing to go to city council and complain and whine about people fighting and what's going on over there. It is another to see the kind of violence that we're talking about here. So I really do commend you. But we decided to take, like, how are we going to tell this story in a way that people want to read it and not just say to themselves, I'm tired. I already read that story. I'm tired of reading about that. And really try and explain and bring our readers in a caring way. And so we decided to do a series of conversations and talk to us about, like, I personally wrote one. It'll be online late tonight for tomorrow. I've stayed in touch with MJ Whitehead's family. He's an 8-year-old who was shot in East Westwood. And he did survive, but he was shot in the head. And he did come home from the hospital, but their lives are very, very different. And it is not, you know, at this point, the miraculous recovery that his family is hoping for. They're still praying. And so that is going to be my part of it. But we talked to a lot of different people. And this touches, you know, this community in so many ways. So can you tell us the different pieces that people can look for?
Yeah, there's a number of conversations. Yours, obviously. There's the one today about the woman who lives in a in a bad neighborhood and the kind of violence that she sees. We had a children's hospital ER doctor talk about what he sees in the emergency room and just kind of the kind of damage that bullets do to kids' bodies. We have a juvenile court judge and there's several other conversations as well, about 10 of them, I think. And it's going to cap off on this weekend with another story about kids who experience violence.
Yeah, and that story, which is slated for Sunday, is actually a conversation with some kids who live in these neighborhoods that witness what we're talking about every day firsthand.
Yeah, Sherry, and you know, guys, I know, you know, you're our reporters. Kevin, you cover courts. Cam, you cover cops. You see so much, and you know, Sherry alluded to that. And I think one thing that our listeners and our readers appreciate is when we're, you know, we sort of take them behind the story a little bit, and you know, you see so much of this. How is that for you guys to, you know, on a daily basis when you see so much hurt and pain in this world? How do you handle that? What you know, what's that like for you? And you know, Kevin.
It never gets easy, and you really have to just take as a reporter. I just have to approach it as a reporter and not and take the emotion out of it and just look at the facts. And you know, behind the scenes on this, we talked about at the beginning. There's always violence and homicides and kids, but this year in particular, and Cam talked about it too, about you know, the number of kids who were shot, but this year was just really, really bad. And I think people are worried that it's not going to get better because there aren't easy answers.
Yeah.
And that's hard to deal with as well.
Cam, how about you?
Yeah, I mean, for me, how I deal with it. I mean, I could just come home and hug my kids mostly.
Yeah. And you're both dads.
And try to realize too that this is, while tragic, this is only affecting a certain number of kids. It's not like every kid who lives in the city is dealing with this. But the part of the project that struck me the most was just we were able to talk to these probation officers who don't normally talk to the press. And they just have a really interesting insight because they work with these kids day in and day out. And they're trying to put them on the right path after they've already gotten in some trouble. And the thing about it for me that kind of helped me put it all in perspective was that for them, it's a flip of a coin whether one of their kids ends up behind a gun or in front of it. Yeah. They know that with the situations these kids are in, when a homicide happens, it could just as easily be their kid pulling the trigger or their kid getting shot. So for them, the group of kids that they worry about is all of them. It's the kids that get hurt. It's also the kids the kids that do end up killing people could have just as easily become victims because the environment and the rest of the circumstances of their life make them more vulnerable to being victims as well. And seeing their sort of holistic look at these kids and that they need to help all of them, all the kids that are suffering this kind of stuff in the city, they need to help all of them work through it. And we need to tackle the whole problem. That gave me a little bit of hope knowing that it's not completely irrational. It's not completely illogical. There are people on the ground working on this issue and they are doing the best they can. And while they might need more help or while it might not be a quick fix, there is a lot of work being done.
Well, guys, great work and great work by, everyone here who's working on the project, Sherry and Amy Wilson, the editor, and just so many others who have, put a lot of effort into this and, appreciate what you guys do. It's not easy work and, you guys you're pros and, great at what you do. So thanks so much for sharing about the project and folks can be looking on that every day, Cincinnati.com and running in the print Inquirer as well. And Sherry, did you want to
ask? What's the key word, you guys? It's kids and kids and guns.
Kids who kill.
Kids okay. who kill, yep.
So, I mean, it is wrapping up on Sunday, but these stories are living on our website still.
Yep.
Scroll down on the app, like the past days ones tend to be there. But I mean, if you care about this topic in our city, these stories tell it in a different way than we've heard before, I think.
Yeah, and the impact, the work that you're doing is having an impact, and I know people are going to be moved to try to get involved and help. And so, yeah, folks, you want to catch up on that series, just go to Cincinnati.com, search Kids Who Kill, and you'll be able to see our full coverage and series. So thanks, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Special guest time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. Pleased to welcome restaurateur Christian Piatoso. Christian, how you
Good
doing?
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm just happy I pronounced your name correctly as we were just discussing off air. I nailed it the first time and had some help from Sherry, who's a fellow Italian. So, or to you, how you doing?
I'm doing great. We're the last stretch of the year that it's exciting because we're busy and it's fun to be out. So restaurants are bustling this time of the year, despite, some current legs of the pandemic going on. People are comfortable coming out. So we're happy and busy.
That's music to the ears to hear you say you're busy. Isn't that, how exciting is that to be able to say you're busy right now after the last year and a half, shoot, almost 2 years now.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the pandemic was, you know, the past couple of years, pandemic or not, I mean, have been crazy because every day, you know, we had to try to figure out what would the next day look like. But, you know, luckily we had a really good group of restaurateurs in the city that confronted each other in a constructive manner and then brought up ideas into the group and situations. And, you know, we kind of held each other up, which was an incredible feel to be a part of this. And then, you know, slowly as, you know, we get a hold of this, you know, we gotten better and better. And then after the restriction were lifted back in June, you know, people started being more confident coming out, and obviously the vaccines are helping and all that jazz. And at the end of the day, humans are social, and, you know, you can only hold people apart for so long. And, you know, everyone feels like it's time to go out now. And so our restaurants are busy, and I suppose everyone else is doing just as good. So we're blessed.
You cannot get a reservation in this city between now and the end of the year. I can actually attest to that.
Not that people
shouldn't try, because I don't want to deter people. But no, it is like the highlight nights, you know, Thursday through Sunday. The things are booked.
Yeah. Yeah. We're busy. We're busy on Mondays as well, which is one of our actually busiest days of the week. The foreigners are busy on Tuesday. So overall, we're happy. And all of our restaurants are closed on Sundays, just FYI.
So
that was a commitment. Yeah.
You are one of the restaurants that's opened on Mondays. Do you feel like that's part of the pandemic, or just why are restaurants often closed on Mondays? I feel like it's more now after the pandemic than it was.
Right. Well, I mean, I can't speak to everyone else, but, you know, historically, even in Italy, when I lived in Italy, most of the restaurants that I worked at that time were closed on Mondays. Kind of like the most logical day for most to be closed, because, you know, that's kind of like the normal, quote unquote, normal people beginning of the week. So that's where everybody, you know, it went out, you know, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday potential. So Monday is kind of like the beginning where everyone rests. But there's opportunities for those who are actually open to do good business, because, you know, there's still plenty of people out that they feel like they do want to go out. So from a perspective of a restaurant, it could be good. You know, my dad created, for example, at Nicola's, my dad created the Bowl of Monday about 15 years ago out of nothing, just because he wanted to beef up his Monday business. And then it turned out 15 years later, it turned out to be, you know, just as good as a Friday night.
So I do have to say, like, I was contemplating, I was like, should we talk about neighborhood night on Monday? I was like, because the more you talk about it, the less secret it is. It is very busy, but you have half price bolognese. Is that when you say bolo night, that's what you're talking about, right?
The bolognese, yes.
And
the
bolognese is Monday. Yeah. It's incredible. And
thank you.
And it's packed, and it is supposed to be neighborhood night, but I feel like it's just a huge draw. It feels like a Friday or a Saturday night on Mondays.
It is. It started as a neighborhood special 15 years ago, and it originally was just at the bar, and then eventually became bigger and bigger. And so now we offer it throughout the restaurant. It's just, you know, just a special night. And we do the same at the Fortnoz on Tuesday, which draws just as good as the crowd. Obviously, the restaurants are smaller, but we're just as busy. So we took upon that, and we built it on Tuesday, and we've done it since we opened the first Fortnoz 6 years ago, and it's been good since. So it's a good deal. But going back to the Sunday thing, you know, we, you know, Amanda and I, my wife and I, made a commitment last year that, you know, through the pandemic, you know, we were evaluating our life as people and restaurateurs and business owners at the same time, all three together. And we said, well, you know, what changes can we make to make everyone's lives better, ours and those who work with us? And one of the first thing that came out to mind was Sunday. Sunday was a big deal. You know, I mean, I have a lot to say about how people feel about the restaurant business, but one thing that important for most people is to try to have that day where it's kind of like off day, that it brings a little bit normality, if you want to put it that way, right? Yes, we will continue to be open on Easter and Mother's Day as far as Sunday goes. But beyond those, we really are going to stick to no Sundays at all. You know, Yavita, for example, was open 7 days a week, lunch and dinner, and the Fortnos were open both brunch Sunday and Sunday dinner, and we committed to not doing that. So that's a big step.
That actually makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I grew up with like my big Italian family and Sunday dinners. Mm-hmm. Those were non-negotiable. We were not allowed to do things with our friends. We could do things like after church, but we had to be at dinner. And that's, you know, how we were so close with our grandparents and everybody.
Yeah. That's a good commitment we made, and we're sticking to it.
Christian, you know, you talk about staying the course during the pandemic and, you know, people all the restaurateurs banding together. It made me think Nicola's has been in Over the Rhine since, 25 years? Is it?
Yeah, almost 26.
Almost 26 years. And you think about staying the course. You were in Over the Rhine before Over the Rhine was cool. And
my dad was. But yeah.
Your dad was, yeah, right. The restaurant itself, yes. Talk about the evolution of Nicola's and staying the course in Over the Rhine, and how you've seen that neighborhood transform as you know, why your dad even took the chance to open a restaurant there almost 26 years ago.
The hunger of the immigrant, I call it. So my dad immigrated to America early 90s. Following his two brothers' footsteps, you know, 20 years prior. So the other two guys, which are in St. Louis, my uncles, are in St. Louis, one of which is a very successful restaurateur as well, with the number of restaurants they're doing incredibly well. They have been. You know, he moved to St. Louis and then married his second wife at that time, Maureen, which became his business partner and life partner for the past 25 years. So he unfortunately just passed a year ago, but they were together all along. And, you know, anyway, so he decided that he wanted to open up a restaurant. And then, you know, he had an opportunity to, you know, somebody called and said, there's an opportunity here in Cincinnati to open up a restaurant. You know, they want to come and check it out. And I bet you that if you asked him 25 years ago to put Cincinnati in the map, he would have not been able to. And but you know, at the same time, he had basically nothing to lose. You know, he was a hungry immigrant that was willing to work hard. And this is the beauty of this country, right? If people call it the land of the opportunity, you know, the opportunity is there, you just need to chase it. We can talk about that too, but you know, the opportunities are there. Yep. And so he came over here, and he had no idea where Cincinnati was, let alone Over the Rhine. But, you know, he had this opportunity to open up Nicola's, and he did. And then think about the incredible endurance that this guy had going through the challenges of being in that corner.
Yeah.
Right? You know, he opened in 96. Then the first thing happened were the riots. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, the riots. And then September 11th. And then the financial meltdown. Now the pandemic in that area. And yes, before it was the quote-unquote scary neighborhood all over the Rhine. Now is the cool place of OTR. So, you know, 3CDC and the city have done an incredible job, in my view. Kudos to them. You know, chapeau to them of changing the perspective of how the area feels like. But, you know, the beginning was really my dad in that corner when it was Over the Rhine. So
yeah,
kudos to him to be the, you know, the beginner of all this.
He took a chance long before anyone else, anyone else took a chance.
By a long shot, a good 15 years.
That's right.
Were you here then, or were you in Italy?
I didn't hear you. I'm sorry.
Were you here then, or were you in Italy?
No, I was in Italy. I moved here in 2004. I was in Italy, actually, and I remember seeing on the news Cincinnati police cars on the news driving around, and I couldn't really understand what was going on, and those were the riots. So it was such a big deal that it was actually broadcast that in Italy. I was born and raised in Italy, and I moved here when I was 27 in 2004.
And did your dad put you to work immediately?
Right away. So, yeah, we, you know, we, him and I were going back and forth because, you know, I've always had the passion to be in the industry, not only just the passion, but, you know, him and I went to the same school, by the way, in the same Culinary Institute of Florence, which we took different branches of the institute, but we went to the same school. So, you know, I was already in the business to begin with. I started when I was 14, and him and I were in contact, and we were waiting for the green card to be approved, which took a long time, but eventually it came. But, you know, in the discussion that him and I had this fear of, you know, bringing up Americanized Italian cuisine in my system. And you know, I told my dad back then, and I said, look, I'm going to tell you right now, if I'm coming, obviously, I want to be reunited with you and, you know, and be together. But from a professional standpoint, I want to do what it will be true Italian cuisine in Italy. And he said, Ciccio, that's my nickname. He said, Ciccio, you come and you have carte blanche. You know, you do whatever you think it's necessary to do the cuisine that you want to do, which was a great platform for me to come to basically start working in a restaurant that was already established and try to basically build upon the legacy that he built already back then. Because I arrived in 2004, but he was already here in 96. So, and the first thing we did was change the bread offering at that time. Since there's a story, you know, there's, I always say Cincinnati had no good bread at that time. You know, it was kind of depressing coming from Italy. You know, to me, you know, bread and the quality of the pasta were the two non-negotiable things, right? And so, you know, at that time, Cincinnati had not experienced the culinary or restaurant renaissance that it experienced just a few years after that. You know, everything really started in 2007, basically, right?
Yep.
But for the first 3 years, it was like, oh boy, you know, the only decent bakery was Shadow Bakery right in Main Street, right?
Yes.
Which it was good. I mean, yes. It was very rustic, somewhat inconsistent, but at least it was real. It was crafty. After that, the next two that they come to mind are Blue Oven Bakery and now LA. But prior to that, there was nothing. So the first thing I did was create our bread basket. And the beauty of this bread basket, that despite me leaving and focusing on Via Vita afterwards and not operating Nicola's for a number of years, and the subsequent chefs that have worked after that, and most of these guys that came in after were basically indirectly successors of my original sous chef that became a chef, and then everybody came after Joel that eventually moved to Chicago and worked at Alina. Anyway, so he trained all the new guys to make this bread basket. So here we go. 17 years later, the bread basket is still there, and it became an iconic part of what Nicola's offerings are, which is kind of a pretty big deal.
I could have a podcast just about the bread basket. Tell us the different things in it and why they all go so amazing together?
Bread basket?
What kind of bread do you have in it, and why does it go together with everything?
Yeah, so there's a buyer, variety of breads in the basket. So we have the breadsticks. They're really pretty to look at and crunchy. They're kind of like a little snack, right? And then the basket, that is served basically aside from the bread basket, but it's a component of it. And then there's the black olive, or actually Kalamata olives and rosemary focaccia. the truffle oil focaccia, the little focaccinas with the little round focaccina top with three different toppings. We have the onion, the tomato basil, and the zucchini with chili flakes. And then we have the honey walnut rolls. So it's kind of like a large variety of offering. And it's like literally, if you go to Nicole, if you've been there the past couple of days back to back, so you've seen it, you literally can turn around. Every single table has a bread basket on a table, which is, it's awesome to look at. It makes me feel good.
It is. And it is very pretty. It isn't just delicious. It's very pretty. So 4-0 is the newest addition, right, to everything?
4-0 Montgomery is, yes.
And how do the restaurants differ?
I'm sorry?
How do the restaurants differ?
Well, the four restaurants?
Mm-hmm.
Well, very much so. So let's start from Nicola's. You know, briefly, obviously Nicola's is our quote-unquote flagship, if you want to put it that way. That's, you know, the longest-lasting restaurant, and it's a true fine dining experience, top to bottom. An incredible wine list and super furnished wine cellar, you know, white tablecloth, you know, top-notch service and all of that. Then we have our Metropolitan restaurant that it's, you know, edgy, stainless steel glass right in the middle of the city, which, by the way, Via Vita, we're about to redo entirely. So Via Vita has been open for 14 years now, and we've done that a couple of refresh. But we are closing in January. January the 8th is our last day for 1 month. And we're redoing the entire restaurant. Kitchen,
wow.
Kitchen, bar, dining room, light fixtures, piazza bar, awnings, you name it. Everything brand new. Private rooms upstairs. And so that's really exciting because we're going to remodernize and really make that super edgy again and feel exactly what it should be for a contemporary Italian restaurant smack in the middle of the city. We're really, really, really thrilled about this operation. It's going to be beautiful. Really excited about it.
Will it still kind of keep that the stainless steel look or be something different?
The structure of the building won't change. Is all the decor inside is changing. So the pizza oven's going away, and we're basically creating a pasta station, a pasta crafting station right by the entrance. So as soon as you walk into the door, you'll have this glass panel that go all the way out to the ceiling with the pasta extruder and pasta machines, and we're going to be making our pastas. In view of the guests walking in the door, our gnocchi is going to be made in the evening, so everyone can see all of this crafty pasta being made throughout the shift. So we're really thrilled about this. The bar will be a completely different shape. We have a beautiful, brand-new espresso machine that is pool-operated. It's just so beautiful. Now, unfortunately, some of these pieces, you know, due to the pandemic and being everybody is behind schedule, may not be arriving in time for reopening, but within a month after that, everything will be complete. Oh, we also have a brand new wine cellar that we're building at eye level next to the bar with the 600 bottle capacity right next to it. So we have one downstairs, which we will keep the spillover and boxes or where we will build our, you know, vintages. And then the one above, that's the one that we will use for everyday use. That's pretty awesome. All three rooms upstairs are going to be private.
Are you changing the menu?
Yes. So obviously we will keep the icon dishes that we cannot change. And we will not change. So the bolognese will stay. The crispy gnocchi will stay. The cioppino in the winter will stay. The braised lamb shank will stay. And a few other staples will stay, and then everything else will change. So we have our corporate chef, Steven, our corporate trainer, Adam, and our chef de cuisine, Derek, all three of them and myself, all four of us working on it continuously. So we've taken trips out to get ideas. And so we've been testing for the past month or so And obviously we had to pause this month because December is crazy for all of us. But we were resumed through the first 2 weeks of January. And every day everybody is like pounding on it. And so we will have the menu finalized 3 or 4 weeks prior to reopening.
What kind of place, where did you go to look at to kind of get ideas?
We went, there's a place in Chicago that I think is really, really trendy and in a good way. They do a fabulous job. It's called RPM. It's owned by a group of restaurants or a holding called Let Us Entertain You. So they have several restaurants, and even in the RPM segment, they have RPM Steak, RPM Seafood, and they have RPM Italian, which I think does a phenomenal job. So I took my entire team there, general manager, assistant, chef, prep people in the morning. Literally, there was like 15 of us. We all went just 4 or 5 months ago. And then our chef, Derek, went also again to Chicago to a place called Gibson's, and then another place called Monteverde. It's a pastificio. That's a pasta restaurant, where I took my group just maybe less than 8 or 9 months ago.
So this is just like regular work, right? So that's the kind of work.
Somebody had to do that too, huh?
Right? Someone had to do it, right? We'll go to Chicago's best Italian restaurants. Okay. Although, I mean, to be fair, I feel like Chicago should come here and see Nicola's and they could bring back ideas to Chicago.
What was that? I'm sorry.
That I think that Chicago should come to Nicola's and get ideas, and they can bring them back to Chicago.
It's their time now. And then the last one you were asking is Forno. So Forno was born out of basically, you know, like, you know, when we opened Forno, we were already working on opening up our burger joint downtown Americana, which we actually sold right at the beginning of the pandemic. Before the pandemic hit. So that was like, you know, a moment. You know, I was really wanting to open up a burger joint for years. And so Amanda and I were working and opening Americano downtown. And a friend of mine that owned the current Forno location, it was called M at that time, Alex, called me and said, hey, you know, I'm looking to basically retire. Are you interested in buying this restaurant? And, you know, the first time he called me, I said, well, you know, I'm already busy. I have Via Vite. We're about to open up another restaurant. So I think we're on hold for now, but thank you. And then he called me back, you know, a couple months later, and he said, hey, I'm like really ready to move. Are you sure you're not considering on buying this restaurant? And so basically I twisted my wife's arm at that time in June of 15 to basically open two restaurants back to back. And so we ended up opening Forno actually before we opened Americana. So in 6 months, we opened two. We opened Forno in August and we opened Americana in December of 2015. And that was the first thing. And it was really exciting because Forno was... It felt immediately like a cozy, rustic Italian restaurant where you will feel like you would expect to have authentic Italian cuisine at its core without any frills, where people could just put the guard down and just go eat a really good meal, feeling like they could be in Italy without having to take the plane to get there. And that's basically became our motto. And the name was given by the custom-built pizza oven that it's right smacked in the middle of the dining room, essentially. Or right in the middle of the kitchen, but it's visible to the dining room. And it was funny because we had our marketing team and our director of operation and my wife, and everybody was trying to come up with the name. And, you know, and I stopped everybody and I said, guys, well, I got the name right here. And they were like, well, what is it? And I'm like, Forno. They were like, what? What does it mean? I'm like, it means oven. The name is right there. You walk in and this oven speaks to you. It's simple to understand. It has a true meaning, and we can do all sorts of fun things in this pizza. It's obviously pizza became a big part of the menu, but not only. You know, we baked the cauliflower gratins in there. We baked the eggplant parmesan in there, et cetera, et cetera. So that's how Forno was born, the first one. And then it was wildly successful, thankfully, thanks to the team that it was an opening team with us. And some of them actually are still with us. And then we had the opportunity of basically expanding the brand to another location in a great neighborhood of Montgomery, which is surrounded by other really good neighborhoods with the residential all around it. You know, we have Montgomery, Blue Ash, Indian Hill, Madeira, all within, you know, a very short drive. And so, you know, we had the opportunity to expand the brand there, except that location did not have a Forno in the restaurant. So we had to custom build it in the middle of the dining room because it didn't exist. So that was kind of a challenge, but we made it happen. And now it's our second location.
I do think we talk so much about downtown restaurants in the media that we forget about the outlying restaurants and how great it is up in the suburban, the more suburban area. I will say Keith Pandolfi, the Inquirer's food writer, he's really been kind of like trekking out and trying to like hit some different places. But we have such a great food scene downtown. I think it's hard sometimes.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last piece of it.
I think we have such a great food scene downtown now. It's hard. There's like lots of things coming online.
Yes, there's definitely tons of stuff downtown. Oops. Visitors. Good morning, I'm on the phone. Hi. But you know, there's, you know, Cincinnati in general has grown an incredible, incredible network of fabulous restaurants all around. So I'm just blessed to be part of this, period. And yes, of course, downtown is fun because there is plenty of stuff to do, especially when there's shows going on. Obviously, last year it was kind of a pause, but, you know, between shows or, you know, sporting events, you name it, or music, there's power concerts, whatever. It's kind of a destination thing. But, you know, on a daily basis, you know, there's plenty of really good restaurants. And, you know, the Forno, in our case, are great because they're kind of like implanted into really good neighborhoods, you know, High Park or Montgomery. So it's good. And they're, you know, everyday type of thing.
Speaking of plenty good restaurants, you and Amanda want to go out on a date. But you're not going to go to one of your restaurants. What restaurant do you pick to go out to?
Yeah, good question. We just did the other day, actually. We, you know, it's December is such a crazy month that it's hard for us to find time to. But, you know, the other day I worked and, you know, I got home around, I don't know, 8:30 or so. And I said, let's go out. I said, let's go out. And I really wanted to go to Bouquet because I hadn't been there in a minute. And it was kind of late. And so we ended up actually going to the Quarter Bistro in Marymount.
Good choice.
And it was great. You know, we had, first of all, the partner owner was, engaging in the dining room. He was talking to people, polishing glasses, turning heaters on for the guests outside, which we were in. It felt really good. The service was great. The food was really good too. And the weather was the kind of like the cherry on the cake. And it was, you know, unusually hot, just like today, actually.
Yeah.
For December. It was, you know, 9 o'clock at night with all these heaters around us and basically a 50-degree weather. We felt like we were in Napa type of thing. It felt like California. So that was great.
But
that's,
I mean,
just the
really,
most recent.
I mean, even yourself as an owner, you're in the restaurant. And mm-hmm. you were there last night. You showed up at the table checking on things, how things are going to go. And I think we do see that a lot here where we have chefs. You're all starting to really be written about in national publications. And then here you are. You're just right out on the floor.
I mean, it's I don't know if it's sometimes maybe it's a fault or if it's it's a plus, but I enjoy it. It's a fault in the sense that, you know, I have plenty of stuff to do on my plate. And so that's how I end up being on my computer at midnight, try to finish up all my daily routine, right? But I also enjoy being in a restaurant when we're busy, and I enjoy feeling the bustle of how the restaurant field in general, and just helping the team. So I bounce around as needed. Sometimes I'm in the kitchen still. You know, sometimes I work on the line. Sometimes I'm in the dining room. Sometimes you're a sommelier. I'm working on that, by the way. And sometimes I'm your office guy. So I'm fully hands-on.
What is your, for someone who's never been in a Nicola's, what would you recommend to them, absolute dish that you like and that you would say, hey, you should order this?
Right. Well, there's a few, but if you have never been, I don't want it to be sound cliche, but, you know, the bolognese is probably like the go-to. If you've never been, and if you're looking for true Italian pasta made in-house, thin, with quality ingredient, we only use egg yolks, and Italian pasta flour from Italy, you can tell the quality of the product in that dish. And freshly ground beef and veal from the butcher in Finley Market. So that's the quintessential Italian dish, in my view, right? You're looking for that. Now, if you feel like, well, you know, okay, well, I'm feeling a little bit more adventurous, then there's two, three other ones that are just out there. One is the malfatti, which is a really fun preparation with basically two sauces. One is the amatriciana sauce, which is a braised smoked pancetta, or the original one is with guanciale, with the pork jowl, but we make the original one at Via Vita. And Nicola's, we slightly change it using the smoked pancetta. Caramelized onions, red wine, and crushed tomato cooked for a long time. So it's really hearty. And that's basically the filling of this nice little round spheres. And then outside we have the cacio e pepe, which is the butter cheese, black pepper sauce that kind of coats them or outside. So these are the two go-to. And then the other one could be the Recca lamb with the carrot puree and the smoked mushrooms. It's just unbelievable. So these are the few, but I can go on and on.
I was going to say, can you go on and on? Because just sitting here, listening to you describe it is like you could. I can tell your passion, the art of it. I love it.
About the eggplant parmigiana. I can talk about the carpaccio. You name it. Cheese salad.
I wish we could. We'll have to have you back sometime, and maybe the entire episode will be you just going through every dish at every one of your restaurants.
People will be sick of me.
I don't think so,
Christian. Well, thank you so much for joining us here today. Congratulations on all your success of your restaurants. Congratulations on being busy right now. May that continue on into the new year and on into many, many years to come. So thank you so much. And for being here today.
Hey, thank you guys for having me. It's been a pleasure to have you in a restaurant first and here in the podcast after. So thank you again for having me. Have a great holiday, both of you.
Thanks again to Christian Pietoso for joining us here today. Great stuff. Be looking for the all-new revamped Via Vitae. That's brand new. Hot off the presses there, breaking some news. And, you just think 25 years, 26 years of Nicola's and how the foresight and great stuff when he said, what did he say, the hunger of an immigrant. To jump in there and to just go for it.
And
love
it. And keep it going.
Exactly. Love the story. Love the passion. And if you haven't been to any of those restaurants, definitely check them out. Nicola's in Over the Rhine, Via Vitae. Obviously, you won't be able to check out until, well, you can check it out now or in February on Fountain Square, right in smack dab there in the middle of Fountain Square, 4-0 in East Hyde Park, and 4-0 in Montgomery. And Cherry, that brings us to our That's So Cincinnati moment of the week. And you are keyed up and ready to roll because you've got our moment this week. You've captured our moment.
I do. As busy as this time of year is, with, you know, planning for the holidays, but, you know, the news does not stop in December.
No,
and
it doesn't.
It's been a lot. And I think a lot of wrapping up at the end of the year kind of thing, not just at City Hall, but on everybody's beats. It's been really crazy. I took a moment out. A friend of mine went to the Western Art Gallery and really was raving about the exhibit that's there right now. And this is it's the art gallery that's kind of attached to the Aronoff. You go in the side door across from Jeff Ruby's and you go downstairs. And there are two exhibits there right now. The one, I went to hear a talk by G. Horton. He is a black artist in Cincinnati with these beautiful charcoal and pencil drawings, coming of age chapter one, In Search of Self-Identity. It dovetailed in a little bit of what we've been working on because he grew up in Louisville and there was a death of of someone he loved very much, and it's really shown in his art, and he has family members, and he's showing in different ways. And so it was really incredible. And then to hear him talk about his art was great. And there's a second exhibit there, and I was really upset. I had that birthday party last night. She spoke last night. Her name is Candace Odester, and she has The Barbie Is Her Me, A Reflection of Black Women During Quarantine. And this is a series of beautifully done black Barbies, and there's paintings, there's artwork of them. And there's also shadow boxes where the Barbies are shown in different scenes and different eras. And I just kind of wanted to move in a couple of the 70s ones. And I mean, it's the furniture, it's the dolls, it's the fashion. And it was just real. I could have stayed there for hours and hours and hours. And G talked for like 2 hours, and it was just really a great night. So these exhibits are there until January 16th of next year. And I really encourage people, if you're looking for something different to do, if you're downtown, go out to eat, just like we talked about, you know, in the last podcast with 3CDC, really trying to encourage people to go in these restaurants. They're busy, but they're not too like, okay, try and, you know, really go for lunch when you're downtown. And this is really would be a great exhibit to check out.
Go to lunch right at Ruby's across the street because they have lunch during the
– right? They do. They do.
Shameless plug for Jeff. Great stuff. Those sounds like fantastic exhibits. You almost make me want to go to an art gallery. Those just sound like awesome stories.
Perhaps I'll go back. I'll take you and we'll go to lunch.
Definitely the lunch part. thanks to Cam Knight, Kevin Grasha, Inquirer reporters for sharing about the Kids Who Kill series. Again, check that out on Cincinnati.com. If you don't have your digital subscription yet, Cincinnati.com/subscribe. We have always running some kind of great deal on that. Check us out. Give us a shot. Local journalism matters. This Kids Who Kill series certainly, I think, alone exemplifies how important our journalism is, how important journalism is to our community. I'm eager to see how this series moves people to get involved and help help with this problem and in our community. We see it all the time. We hear people say, "Hey, you know, you're I had this during the election. Like I had some people reach out to me, "Hey, your column on the importance of local politics moved me to go vote in my local election this year." Cherry gets, you know, all the time. The work that we do has impact. We cannot do that without you. We really cannot do that without you. I would encourage you just to go check it out. Cincinnati.com/subscribe, all access digital subscriptions. And it's well worth it. And so thank you so much for supporting this podcast. So much, so many of you, I know, I don't know personally, but I have a feeling that you are hyper news consumers, and you already have your digital subscription. So thank you. And we will catch you next week.